This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of spine biomechanics from the spine section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick introduction. We'll talk about the functional spinal unit and spinal stability. So the functional spinal unit is the cephalad and caudad vertebral body, as well as the intervertebral disc and the corresponding facet joints. The function is to provide physiologic motion and protect the neural elements. Keep in mind that intradiscal pressure depends on position. Moving on to spinal stability, this is defined when under physiologic loading, there is neither abnormal strain or excessive motion in the functional spinal unit. This is maintained by the functional spinal unit, muscular tension, abdominal and thoracic pressure, as well as ribcage support. Now let's talk about the three-column theory, and it's important to go over the Denis three-column system. As far as clinical relevance, keep in mind that this is only moderately reliable in determining clinical degree of stability. So as far as definitions, the three columns include the anterior column, middle column, and posterior column. The anterior column contains the anterior longitudinal ligament, or ALL, as well as the anterior two-thirds of the vertebral body and the annulus. The middle column contains the posterior longitudinal ligament, or PLL, and the posterior one-third of the vertebral body and annulus. Finally, the posterior column contains the pedicles, facets, ligamentum flavum, spinous process, and posterior ligamentous complex, or PLC. Instability is defined by injury to the middle column, as evidenced by widening of the interpedicular distance on AP radiograph. It's also defined by loss of height of the posterior cortex of the vertebral body. Instability is also defined by disruption of the posterior ligament complex combined with anterior and middle column involvement. Now let's talk about ligaments. It's important to note that the functional spinal unit is surrounded by 10 ligaments with the functions to protect neural structures by restricting motion of the functional spinal unit and to absorb energy during high-speed motions. As far as contents, know that all ligaments are composed of type 1 collagen except the ligamentum flavum, which is mostly elastin. It's important to note that these ligaments are viscoelastic with nonlinear behavior. Now let's talk about the posterior ligamentous complex in a bit more detail. So the integrity of the posterior ligamentous complex is now considered to be one of the most critical predictors of spinal fracture stability, and it is one of the three primary factors in the thoracolumbar injury classification and severity score, otherwise known as the TLIC scoring system. The other parameters include injury morphology and neurologic involvement. With respect to the posterior ligamentous complex parameter on the TLIC score, an intact posterior ligamentous complex gives you 0 points, suspected injury or indeterminate injury gives you 2 points, and ruptured gives you 3 points. Morphology of the injury is divided into three patterns. Compression, in which a wedge compression fracture gives you 1 point and a burst fracture gives you 2 points. Translation slash rotation gives you 3 points and distraction gives you 4 points. As far as neurologic involvement, intact gives you 0 points, nerve root involvement gives you 2 points, cord slash conus medullaris injury that is incomplete gives you 3 points, cord slash conus medullaris injury that is complete gives you 2 points, and cauda equina involvement gives you 3 points. In terms of anatomy, the posterior ligamentous complex consists of the supraspinous ligament, interspinous ligament, ligamentum flavum, and facet capsule. As far as evaluation, determining the integrity of the posterior ligamentous complex can be challenging. Conditions where the posterior ligamentous complex is ruptured includes a bony chance fracture, widening of the interspinous distance, progressive kyphosis with nonoperative treatment, and facet diastasis. In conditions where there is ambiguity about the integrity of the posterior ligamentous complex, an MRI can show signal intensity between the spinous processes. Treatment for posterior ligamentous complex injury can be nonoperative or operative, and this is based on the TLIC scoring system. So for nonoperative management, according to the TLIC score, let's consider an example. If the posterior ligamentous complex is intact in a compression burst fracture in a patient without neurologic deficits, then the patient should be treated nonoperatively, because an intact posterior ligamentous complex gives you 0 points, a compression burst fracture will give you 2 points, and no neurologic deficits gives you 0 points for a total TLIC score of 2 points, and know that a score of less than 4 points should be treated nonoperatively. For operative management, let's consider another example. If the posterior ligamentous complex is ruptured in a compression burst fracture in a patient without neurologic deficits, then the patient should be treated with surgery because a ruptured posterior ligamentous complex gives you 3 points, a compression burst fracture gives you 2 points, and no neurologic deficit gives you 0 points for a total TLIC score of 5 points, and a score of greater than 4 points should be treated operatively. Now let's talk about spinal balance. specifically sagittal balance. So sagittal balance is due to the normal cervical lordosis, thoracic kyphosis, and lumbar lordosis. Normal range for cervical lordosis is 20 to 40 degrees. Average thoracic kyphosis is 35 degrees, with the normal range being between 20 to 50 degrees. And finally, average lumbar lordosis will be 60 degrees, with a normal range between 20 to 80 degrees. Keep in mind that as much as 75% of lumbar lordosis occurs between L4 and S1, with 47% occurring at L5 S1. In terms of normal alignment, the vertical axis runs from the center of C2 to the anterior border of T7 to the middle of the T12 L1 disc, posterior to the L3 vertebral body, and crosses the posterior superior corner of the sacrum. On radiograph, this is estimated by a plumb line dropped from the center of C7 to the posterior superior corner of S1. Negative sagittal balance refers to the axis being posterior to the sacrum, and this occurs in patients with lumbar hyperlordosis. Positive sagittal balance refers to the axis being anterior to the sacrum, and this occurs in patients with hip flexion contracture or flat back syndrome. Now let's talk about motion of the spine. So the orientation of the facets, which are zygapophyseal joints, determines the degree and plane of motion at that level. This varies throughout the spine to meet physiologic function. So let's talk about the cervical spine, that is defined as C3 to C7, the thoracic spine, and the lumbar spine. So starting with the cervical spine, we'll go over planes and function. So the planes include 0 degrees coronally and 45 degrees sagittally, that is angled superior medially. The function of the cervical spine is to allow flexion extension, lateral flexion, and rotation. Moving on to the thoracic spine, in terms of planes, this will be 20 degrees coronal, 55 degrees sagittal, where the facets are in the coronal plane, and there are 6 degrees of freedom. As far as function of the thoracic spine, this allows some rotation and minimal flexion extension, which is also limited by the ribs. The thoracic spine prevents downward flexion on the heart and lungs. Finally, moving on to the lumbar spine, as far as planes, this is 50 degrees coronal and 90 degrees sagittal, where the facets are in the sagittal plane. As far as function of the lumbar spine, this allows flexion extension and minimal rotation, and it also helps increase abdominal pressure. Finally, moving on to instantaneous axis of rotation, or IAR, this refers to the axis about which the vertebra rotates at some instant in time. The normal functional spinal unit is confined to a small area within the functional spinal unit. An abnormal functional spinal unit, for example, a degenerate disc, shifts outside the physical space of the functional spinal unit, and it will be enlarged dramatically. Now, let's end this review session talking about pedicle anatomy. We'll go over the cervical pedicles, thoracic pedicles, and the lumbar sacral pedicles. So starting with the cervical pedicles, C2 is viable for pedicle screw placement. C3 to C6 have pedicles that are very small, making pedicle screw instrumentation difficult. Lateral mass screws can be placed at C3 to C6 as an alternative. Finally, C7 is viable for pedicle screw placement. Moving on to the thoracic spine, in terms of pedicle diameter, remember that the pedicle wall is twice as thick medially as laterally. Remember that T4 has the narrowest pedicle diameter on average. T7 can be irregular and have a narrow diameter on the concave side in adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. Finally, T12 usually has a larger pedicle diameter than L1. In terms of pedicle length decreases from T1 to T4 and then increases again as you move distal in the thoracic spine. T1 corresponds to a pedicle length of 20 millimeters, T4 corresponds to 14 millimeters, and this is the shortest pedicle, and T10 also corresponds to 20 millimeters. As far as pedicle angles, the ones to know include the transverse pedicle angle and the sagittal pedicle angle. The transverse pedicle angle varies from 10 degrees from the mid-thoracic spine to 30 degrees at L5. The sagittal pedicle angle is 15 to 17 degrees cephalad for the majority of the thoracic spine. The sagittal pedicle angle will be neutral or 0 degrees for the lumbar spine, except L5, which will be caudal. Finally, moving on to lumbar sacral, as far as landmarks, the midpoint of the transverse process is used to identify the midpoint of the pedicle in the superior inferior dimension. The lateral border of the pars is used to identify the midpoint in the medial lateral dimension. In terms of pedicle angulation, remember that the pedicles angulate more medial as you move more distal. So L1 corresponds to 12 degrees, L5 corresponds to 30 degrees, and S1 corresponds to 39 degrees. In terms of pedicle diameter, remember that L1 has the smallest diameter in the lumbar spine, and S1 has an average diameter of approximately 19 millimeters. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic might be tested. First question. An evaluation metric used in spinal biomechanics constituting the theoretical axis about which each functional spinal unit rotates at a point in time is known as the, and the choices are 1, center of rotation of angulation, 2, virtual center of rotation of angulation, 3, instantaneous axis of rotation, 4, vertebral incidence, and 5, vertebral plumb line. The correct answer to this question is 3, instantaneous axis of rotation. So the instantaneous axis of rotation, or IAR, is defined as a theoretical axis about which a functional spinal unit rotates at a discrete point in time. The IAR is not a fixed point, but has been shown to move constantly with bending and rotational moments. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, center of rotation of angulation, and answer 2, virtual center of rotation of angulation are both incorrect, as this refers to the principles of deformity correction. The center of rotation of angulation, or CORA, is defined as the intersection between proximal and distal mechanical axes. Answer 4, vertebral incidence is incorrect, as vertebral incidence has only been described for the L5 vertebral body in the setting of spinopelvic balance and spondylolisthesis. Finally, answer 5, vertebral plumb line is incorrect, as the vertebral plumb line has only been described for the C7 vertebral body in relation to sagittal balance of the spine. The IAR can be used to map the kinematic behavior of the spine. As a result, the IAR can then be used as a metric to compare the biomechanics of the diseased, injured, or postoperative spine to that of an intact, uninjured state. This translates to an understanding of the contribution of the various parts of the spine to pathological motion. Inu et al. Evaluated the impact of spinal fixation on the IAR. The authors compared the kinematic parameters from the injured status to those following pedicle screw fixation and quantified this in terms of the location of the applied mechanical load. They found that pedicle screw instrumentation shifted the IAR and effectively reduced the mechanical load on the posterior neurologic elements. Haar et al. Compared the behavior of the IAR in the uninjured state to that in the setting of isolated sequential destruction of the three columns. The authors noted that the IAR migrated to the intact structures as the spine was sequentially released and determined the importance of the anterior structures in resisting rotational moments. They concluded that an understanding of the contribution of the various structures to spinal stability would influence fixation. And moving on to the final question. Integrity of the posterior ligamentous complex, or PLC, is a critical predictor of spinal fracture stability. Components of the PLC include the supraspinous ligament, interspinous ligament, ligamentum flavum, and 1, facet joint capsules, 2, facet joint capsules and facet joints, 3, facet joint capsules, facet joints, and the posterior longitudinal ligament, 4, facet joint capsules and the posterior longitudinal ligament, and 5, posterior longitudinal ligament. The correct answer to this question is 1, facet joint capsules. So components of the posterior longitudinal ligament include the supraspinous ligament, interspinous ligament, ligamentum flavum, and facet joint capsules. All the other choices are incorrect, as components of the posterior ligamentous complex only include the supraspinous ligament, interspinous ligament, ligamentum flavum, and facet joint capsules. To quickly review, numerous methods have been used to evaluate for posterior ligamentous complex injury. Palpation is unreliable and has low accuracy. Radiographs can show characteristic flexion distraction fracture patterns with widening or malalignment of the spinous processes. Computed tomography, or CT, is more reliable than radiographs to provide indirect evidence of ligamentous injury. MRI can provide direct evidence of soft tissue injury, making it the preferred method in diagnosing ligamentous injury. However, MRI may not always be utilized due to situations involving emergency operations or contraindications to MRI, such as certain metal implants. Vaccaro et al. Introduced a new classification system for thoracolumbar injuries. That is the TELIC score, which is based on morphological appearance, integrity of the posterior ligamentous complex, and neurological status. They advocate the use of this system for non-operative versus operative decision-making and communication between surgeons. Vaccaro et al. Also sought to determine the accuracy of magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, in diagnosing injury of the posterior ligamentous complex in patients with thoracolumbar trauma. 42 patients with 62 levels of injury were studied. The sensitivity for the various posterior ligamentous complex components ranged from 79%, which corresponded to the left facet capsule, to 90%, which corresponded to the interspinous ligament. The specificity ranged from 53%, corresponding to the thoracolumbar fascia, to 65%, corresponding to the ligamentum flavum. They concluded that the integrity of the posterior ligamentous complex, as determined by MRI, should not be used in isolation to determine treatment. That's all for this review about spine biomechanics. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.